Welcome to a Tennis.com podcast, sponsored by Prince XO3 Racket Technology and by American Express. American Express presents Next Contenders. Get to know four of today's game changers in tennis. For more, visit nextcontenders.com.
It's Monday, and that means a bigger number in the loss column for the Buffalo Bills, and it also means the Tennis.com podcast has returned after a weekend of tennis. I'm here, Ed McGrogan, here with Steve Tigner and Peter Bodo, talking a little tennis after a little football. We'll forget about the Bills. They're not really an interesting subject to talk about anyway these days.
Yeah,
but
boy.
That conversation
will go off the cliff.
Yes, talk the fans up there off a cliff. It's really getting ugly up there for any of you Western New Yorkers. But the Davis Cup this weekend wrapped up its semifinal ties and also the World Group playoffs. We're going to start with the semifinals, where both home teams won and advanced this weekend to the final. Serbia came back from 2-1 down after the doubles to beat the Czech Republic 3-2. And they'll be hosting France in the final. France was also the home team in their semifinal. They defeated Argentina much easier, 5-0. They had the tie clinched by Saturday. The bigger storyline certainly would be the way, I guess, Serbia came back, especially when you consider Novak Djokovic. He originally was going to play in the Friday singles matches. He didn't play because of an illness. And he comes back and doubles on Saturday, partners with Zimonjic, who's, of course, a very, very strong doubles player. And they fall in the doubles to go behind. And then on Sunday, Djokovic wins his match, must win against Berdych. And Tipsarevic, who had a strong U.S. Open, clinches it with another win over Stepanek to seal it. It's a very, very impressive result by Serbia when they looked like they're on the ropes. Pete, I know you wrote about that the doubles seemed like it may have been the big chink in the armor that could have did them in, but they ended up coming back on Sunday and they reached their first career Davis Cup final.
Well, yeah, you know, I think they looked awful in the doubles, and you said, oh, you know, you kind of winced and said, there it goes. Poor Zimonjic, you know, he's playing with the big boy now, Novak Djokovic. It's his, you know, perfect moment on a stage to show that he's more than, quote, a double specialist. And, you know, I got to believe the guy really felt the pressure of being at home. And then having to play alongside Djokovic, you can't underestimate the impact that can have on somebody like Zimonjic to suddenly have one of these guys who, let's face it, if the top guys played doubles, they would be among the top doubles players. So he felt a lot of pressure just to sort of keep up his end of the bargain in a way. And Djokovic didn't play very well either. So that was really, really kind of a disaster. What I liked in his tie, though, really was Djokovic's performance. I mean, no question about the fact that Tipsarevic is the hero. But Djokovic was a setup man, and, you know, it would have been pretty easy for Djokovic to, you know, whatever happens in this tie, Djokovic doesn't look too bad because, you know, if he loses the tie, you blame it on a timing, you blame it on a Davis Cup format, you blame it on whatever you want. But so for him to come up and be the setup guy and get Tipsarevic over close to the finish line and then hope that he can make it across was a really good effort. The guy has to be emotionally and physically drained and exhausted after the U.S. Open, and, you know, and there's a lot of pressure at home, too. So he's playing Berdych in fourth match. That could really have gone either way, even though Berdych has not played great tennis in the past month. I give a lot of credit to Novak Djokovic as a setup guy who really turned Tipsarevic into a hero.
Yeah, I think Djokovic seems to me to be a guy like, not a little bit like Murat Safin, where sometimes he, you know, the normal tour, his motivation sort of comes and goes. I mean, he always wants to win, but he can let a match go also pretty easily. But Davis Cup, that forces him not to do that. You know, I think he's a guy whose psyche is made for that kind of event where he's playing for somebody else. And you know, all these guys really want to win the Davis Cup, but I've been amazed at Djokovic's passion for it, you know, ever since he's, you know, he started. You see all kinds of scenes of him whenever he wins, just going ballistic. So he, you know.
Well, let's remember these guys are pretty selfish, basically. I mean, you know, so you get a big star like Djokovic, who's a, you know, legitimately a huge star compared to some of these other guys. And he is like a Safin or a Federer or a Nadal. And some of those guys, Nadal maybe is the biggest exception. You know, it's a little like if it's not about me, I'm sort of out of here. You know, that's a very broad generalization, but it's really kind of true. They, you know, they're looking at their position and they're, you know, focused on what their result, what they've done. And really to be able to swallow that back and do what you got to do for the team, which is what Djokovic did, I think is a pretty good plus on his resume.
Yeah, also Djokovic, he's typically, he's gone at it so hard in Davis Cup that he's, you could say he's hurt himself a little bit in the coming weeks after those matches on tour, but he doesn't, you know, he obviously doesn't care.
Yeah, earlier this spring, I remember for one of their Serbia's ties, I think it was the second rounder, the quarterfinal basically, he kind of disappeared. This was around Indian Wells in Miami, I believe, right after a really he kind of won the tie. I remember this was, I think, also in Belgrade, too. So he's really peaked, I think, throughout the year for these events. And that's why, among other reasons, it looks like Serbia, as impressive as France's win is, we'll get to that in a second, they have a lot of going for them in the final. They'll be hosting it. We were just talking earlier. We haven't determined the surface hasn't been chosen yet, but Serbia is obviously going to pick whatever surface it deems as the most advantageous for them. And Serbia throughout this year in Davis Cup has also shown shown their depth really well. It was more Serbia when you're thinking about their top players, it was about the women with Jankovic and Ivanović, and obviously those are both top 10 players, but you look at the men, what they've done over the past few years, they've developed guys like Troisky into a good solid player, and Tipsarevic in recent months he's always had his moments, but especially of late he's been doing even better. And then you have Zemanjic in the double. So Serbia, I think, definitely is well positioned for the final and when they're going to host France. That's coming up in December. I don't know if you guys have any early thoughts about that, or just thoughts in general on how the rest of the tournament's going to go for them.
I like the Serbs. This is a pretty tough crew, and I think the Serbs are you know, they're going to be deliriously happy. This means a heck of a lot in Serbia. The French, let's remember, the French are one of the sort of have nations in tennis. Serbia has been a have-not for the longest time, and I think they're going to be psyched out of their minds, frankly. And the French are a little bit like, you know, it's big, but there's Roland Garros as well. These guys are stars. They live in, you know, sort of a real Western culture where they make a ton of money doing anything. So they're a little bit soft, I think. And I think in general, the French teams have been soft, you know, just like the French players have been soft in Grand Slams. So to me, you know, the critical thing component here will be Serbia at home. I have a feeling Djokovic is going to walk in there, pound his fist on a table at the Serbian Federation headquarters and say, "You put this tie on a fast indoor hard court, and I'm going to go out there and win two singles, and we're going to win the Davis Cup."
Yeah, I think the tie will be, it'll come down to, you know, Djokovic has the advantage at the top, but the French do have depth, and the French have doubles as well. I would say that they are hungry for it. They've lost a few finals, and they haven't won for a while, and they do have depth. They have, you know, they had Simone and Sanga on the bench this past weekend, and they still won 5-0. As well as a couple of versatile guys, like especially Lodra, who really, you know, has been playing good tennis and won two matches yesterday. He also, so sort of a wild card. There's the Serbs, and rarely do you face a guy who plays exactly like that. So I think the French, even though it's on the road and the Serbs have the best player, the France will make it a good tie.
Yeah, I was wondering what you guys thought about who France might want to use for that. I wrote a little earlier that the combo of Clément and Lodra are very important, I think, to France. They've been one of the best doubles teams in the Davis Cup overall. They beat the Bryan brothers, actually, in the United States a couple of years back. And Lodra has acquitted himself very well this year. He won two matches this past week, and he also, when France beat Spain 5-0, he beat Verdasco. He's had a nice run, but France obviously has a lot of choices to go with, and this is actually the first tie of the year that they're not going to be in France. They've actually played the first three ties all on home, and so I'm wondering if anyone like Monfils or Sanga is a more attractive option, I guess, when you have to combat what you're going to get against Djokovic and most likely Tipsarevic. I don't think we need to say that Geske is not really one of those options. He hasn't been.
Hold your horses up for a second. I mean, we're pretty far out from this tie, though. I mean, it's pretty hard to start picking teams, especially when you got the French players who can be so streaky and who can go on runs. I mean, you know, it's entirely possible that Loger is a game, despite the indoor season coming up in which he theoretically ought to do well, as should Monfils. I mean, you know, there's a chance that either or both of these guys, you know, just sort of chill out and disappear and evaporate a little bit, kind of like the way Burdick has done toward the end of the summer. I mean, these are not the most reliable guys. It's really different if you've got a guy like a Federer or a Roddick or a Djokovic who you know is always going to be there. You know, we know Djokovic is going to play that tie. I think with the French, though, we're way too far out to be talking about sort of personnel, although it's certainly valid that, you know, that their doubles team, for instance, is pretty much a done deal.
Well, Monfils he played well in this tie. He's another guy, yet another guy. You can say this about a lot of guys. That is that Djokovic effect in Davis Cup. He plays a little bit more responsibly, I guess I would say, than when he plays for his team than he did, say, at the U.S. Open against Djokovic. I would imagine he would be a different guy if he played Djokovic in the final of the Davis Cup. I still don't see him winning that match, and he is a risky choice, but he's an interesting choice because he's a guy who could beat anyone. He's very, you know, obviously a talented singles player, and then you know, you also have Tsonga, who's a little bit of a similar guy. I would say Loder is a little bit more reliable, less obvious upside, but is a more reliable guy. So they have a lot of people they can throw at the Serbs and you know, sort of keep that team guessing as to who they're gonna face.
American Express presents Next Contenders, your chance to get up close and personal with four of today's game changers in tennis: John Isner, Sam Querrey, Melanie Udin, and Caroline Wozniacki. Visit nextcontenders.com to follow the excitement during the 2010 U.S. Open and discover the person behind the player. It's tennis trivia time. Here's a chance to test your tennis knowledge with a tennis.com podcast trivia question, brought to you by Prince XO3 Racket Technology. Are you ready? The question is, Valencia, Spain is the hometown of this Prince player who reached his best ever placing in the U.S. Open in 2007. If you think you know the answer to our trivia question, visit the official Prince Tennis Facebook page at facebook.com/official.prince.tennis. Once again, that's facebook.com/official.prince.tennis. Become a fan today and be sure to leave your answer on the Prince wall.
On the lower tier of the Davis Cup this past weekend was the World Group playoffs, where the nations who lost earlier in this year and nations who have won in zonal play, who are seeking to get up to the top tier of the competition, faced off. The winners move on to the World Group next year. The losers remain relegated in that zone and will try to compete to the top spot later on, you know, in future years. And the U.S. was involved in one of those ties this weekend in Colombia, where they're playing high altitude, red clay court, a lot of stuff environment-wise sort of against them a little bit. But Marty Fish was a big hero of this tie because he takes down two singles matches and he teams with John Isner in the doubles. And the U.S. wins the tie in four rubbers and moves on, so they'll be back in the World Group last year. This one was on TV. You guys checked out some of these matches. What did you guys think of this one? Pete, I guess we'll start with you.
Yeah, well, you know, it was interesting watching this tie. I think the Colombians made a critical mistake playing at altitude or with the tree-torn pressureless balls. I suppose it would have been crazy if they went with pressurized balls at that altitude. But, I mean, if I were them, I would have wanted this match down at sea level, where their guys who are, you know, good, solid baseline players, you know, they're, neither of them is a big star, but these guys can grind on clay. And, you know, the one thing that struck me overall was a combination of both the altitude and actually the pressureless balls, which these guys really had trouble dealing with, just in terms of how do I hit this ball? How do I keep it from flying? You know, it feels different on the strings from the balls we play with every week. So it made a level playing field, where you take away the advantage the Colombians would have had on a slow red clay court under normal conditions and actually put a little bit of an advantage to the Americans because, you know, let's face it, Marty Fish is a high-skilled player. Neither Faya nor Giraldo is in the same league in terms of being able to do different things and being able to win different ways. I think we saw a little bit of that in the Fish match. You know, Marty actually did some good damage from the baseline, even though he had a shaky moment. So I think it was kind of a tactical error of Colombia to choose that altitude with those balls. It did not really – it was not the ideal setup for – you know, going in, Fala had predicted that they're going to – basically make the Americans work for every point and grind it out and all this other stuff. And then they go and they play the match on a court where that really wasn't called for and couldn't really be done because of the combination of altitude and pressureless ball. So it was kind of a bizarre final in that regard. But, you know, props to Moore. She did a great job. First American since Pete Sampras, I think, 95 in Moscow to win three ties win three rubbers in a Davis Cup tie.
The other thing I thought that hurt the Colombians, hurt the two singles players, was actually just playing in front of their home fans. Both of those guys got close to winning the match, Faya and Giraldo, and they both choked. I mean, Fish hung around. He let them implode. He didn't choke. That was the difference in the end. Giraldo got the crowd incredibly, you know, riled up, served for the match, and then couldn't get the ball over the net. So in that sense, I think even playing at home, it didn't – not that playing away would have been better, but they didn't – they didn't react. Those two guys didn't react well to the occasion, you know, at the end of those matches. So, but Marty Fish did, and yeah, you're right, Pete. You could see the way they were hitting the ball with, you know, with the altitude and the pressureless balls. It was very different, very careful tennis. I thought it was fun to watch. It's a little different. You could see them trying to decide when to let go, when to hit hard, when to go for shots. They couldn't just do it when they normally do. But overall, great, great moment for Marty Fish. I remember him at the 2007 Davis Cup final when the U.S. won. He was there. He was hanging around. He was just, you know, he was just a practice partner. Somebody asked him how he felt about it, and, you know, he said he was just honored to be part of the team, and he's hung around for a long time, and I think he got his reward this weekend.
One of the great things about this tie, I thought, was that Patrick McEnroe went with Fish. I mean, is it just, you know, it maybe is, you know, maybe a little bit too much inside baseball for the general world audience, but certainly for Americans interested in Davis Cup and our history and these characters, you know, Marty Fish has done a lot of time. Patrick has told me, in fact, that Marty Fish, you know, he respects Marty an awful lot because Marty spent a lot of time overshadowed by James Blake and Andy Roddick, who were the stalwarts of the Davis Cup team for most of Pat McEnroe's tenure. So, you know, there was kind of a poetic justice or a great symbolism in the fact that, you know, basically Patrick gave Marty the balls and said, you know, almost as if he said, here, you did a lot of due diligence. You always showed up. You were a practice partner. You did whatever we asked. You played doubles. You sat the bench. You did whatever. Now, here it is. This is your tie. It's an important tie. It's a relegation tie, playoff tie. It's, you know, here's a ball. You put it in the court and win this thing for us. And Marty really, really responded and put in, you know, kind of a really memorable performance, I think, all things considered. So I just like the symmetry of that in a way, you know. Kudos to Captain McEnroe. It's almost like it sort of closed a circle on us and created a sense of closure around this American effort that he spearheaded for about a decade.
Did either of you guys get to check out the matches involving Querrey or Isner at all? And Fish is obviously the big name that comes out of this tie. Isner, he always strikes me as sort of an odd doubles player, but he's actually had some pretty good wins on there, and you can always, a big serve is good no matter what format you're playing, of course. And then Querrey on day one, he lost the second match, I believe it was the second match of the day, in pretty routine fashion. Did either of you guys catch how they were playing this past
week?
He lost
to Giraldo pretty quickly. Giraldo was good in that match. He didn't choke in that match. He was very steady. I think he used the conditions to his advantage. He just played very steady percentage tennis and sort of wore Querrey down. It was not a good match for Sam. And Isner, you know, Marty Fish is the more versatile doubles player, but Isner had the serve and obviously he has the serve, but it was a big factor in that match. That was one thing that really gave the Americans an advantage was the ability to hit with power in that doubles match which their opponents didn't have, and you know Isner really brought that. So he's an interesting person to throw into the double. He's very, you know, has that wide reach, has the huge serve. You know, he does make it tough. And, you know, people don't see that kind of guy in a doubles match too often.
I'd add on that note, the on the same fish note, not to be a one note band here, but you know, it was interesting that Pat chose to go with him in that fourth match. You know, he you know, in a rather decisive match, because he you know, he could have subbed him out. I guess he could have had Isner go in there, who played a good doubles match. You know, Marty had to be tired after going, you know, five setter in first singles and then playing on a winning doubles. It was kind of a good opportunity to sort of to switch it around a little bit if he wanted to, but he stuck with it. And you know, 8-6 in the fifth, three matches, two long five setters plus a doubles in between. That's a pretty fair 3 days work.
I forget how the format goes. What if it went to a fifth rubber? Was he stuck with Isner, or could he do Query or Isner if it went the distance?
Well, they have some time to make that substitution, but they could have made that substitution. I mean,
could have played either guy.
Yeah, you saw the way the way Serbia made that substitution. All right, they pulled Djokovic in the beginning, and had the guy play instead of him, and then they reinserted Djokovic instead of what's his name, the other Serbian player who played in his place, Troisky, inserted him for the fourth match. So yeah, they had options there. The U.S. had options. McEnroe had options.
Okay. Yeah. Well, they'll always definitely have. It seems some depth in the next couple of years. They'll have a new coach coming up next year after Pat McEnroe's last tie, as Pete said. So see where that brings the U.S. in the years to come. So we'll be back later in the week with another podcast. Thanks again for Pete Bodo and Steve Tigner. I'm Ed McGrogan.
You've been listening to the Tennis.com podcast, sponsored by American Express. American Express presents Next Contenders. Get to know four of today's game changers in tennis and follow their moves during the 2010 U.S. Open. For more, visit nextcontenders.com. And also by Prince XO3 Racket Technology. For more news and information, head over to tennis.com. Thanks for listening.